I want to carry on a bit from the talk of yesterday. What did I decide to name that talk? That Bennett has it there.
They travel fastest
who are not there. That's what I thought I'd give the name of that talk from yesterday. And that I was talking about the grasping of the will yesterday and how the grasping of the will needs to involve a movement in a positive direction. A movement in a positive direction. So, I want to talk a little bit more about the principle, the teaching principle that lies behind that. And the truth of that teaching principle is based on the way I like to think of that teaching principle is the way I learned it from Reverend Master, and that is that, you know, that everything that happens is for my good. So let's just stop before I talk about, you know, the basically the truth that teaching rests upon. Just look for a moment at some of the practical results of taking that point of view and making that a feature of training or a foundation of actual training. First of all, what is it that you distance yourself from when you take that point of view? Well, to me, the most obvious first thing that you distance yourself from is complaining. And if you've ever seriously tried complaining, you know, I mean, it really put some real work into it, not just kind of half-hearted complaining, but some, you know, real serious complaining. Well, you know, what you learn after a while is that once you're down the road of complaining, it's endless. It's endless. There's no bottom to the pit. You can just keep going down that road, and you'll turn everything. In the end, you can turn everything dark. And everything can be dirtied in your mind, basically. And everything is then subject to doubt. And I don't mean questioning, I mean skeptical doubt. Everyone's motive is suspect. Every event is suspect. You know, and another cause of irritation. And, you know, the thing about complaining, again, if you've done wholehearted complaining, it helps for this rather than half-hearted complaining. Because half-hearted complaining, you kind of have a sense of it. Wholehearted complaining actually leads to the hellish state that is itself a great teaching about, you know, what not to do. Because complaining does end you up, if you do it wholeheartedly, it ends you up in a hell. In a state of torment, basically, spiritual torment. So, let's go back to the starting point of that little digression, and that is, you know, what is it that taking everything that happens is for my good as a teaching principle, in other words, something that you're going to try to put into practice in some way, what is it that automatically starts to distance you from? It's complaining. It's complaining. And another way to put it is it helps accomplish the really difficult transition, if one is needed, from what is basically a negative point of view to a more positive point of view. This doesn't mean that in itself it solved anything. But it helps. It helps to start to distance yourself from what doesn't work so that you can then find what does work. If you remember in Red Master's diary, in the first volume of The Wild White Goose, where it's recorded there, Red Master put it this way. She said, if I don't take everything that happens as being for my good here, I will surely go mad. That's the way she put it. And this is the thing. If you're in a relatively easy circumstances, the need to take everything that happens as being for your good isn't as obvious as if you're in really, really tough circumstances and really up against it. Then, you know, the consequences, if you have any sense, the consequences of taking a negative route in your mind and then in your actions, you know, are more dire, actually. This is why in the most extreme kinds of circumstances, you see people acting so differently. Take like concentration camps from the everyone's, you know, like since World War II, since that time, you know, everyone's idea of like the one of the ultimate hells to end up in is in a concentration camp. And it was what were those places but places that people created which was about as much like a hell as you can think of. You know, kind of a hell manifesting in the human realm where some people were behaving as demons and other people as the victims of the demons. And with a almost relentless cruelty and malice in it, and that's a good depiction of how we kind of envision a hell, isn't it? Really, a real hell. And yet, even in those circumstances, there's stories of people behaving with amazing unselfishness and amazing compassion. And that makes it clear that it isn't just external circumstances that control us, that there's something within ourselves that's more fundamental, that we have a choice about, the kind of attitude we're going to take. And there's famous stories of people who, in their life in the world, they were not particularly... and did not think of themselves being particularly religious, for example, but who in those circumstances exhibited amazing compassion. So they certainly in their daily lives up until when they were in a concentration camp, they didn't give any indication that they were going to behave as saints. But in that situation, something in them rose to the occasion. And they did exhibit an amazing degree of selflessness. I guess until we're in such circumstances, none of us knows what we'll do, how we'll behave. It's one of those really humbling cautionary notes, you know, that I always have in my back of my mind, you know. And until I've walked another mile, you know, until I've walked a mile in another man's shoes, be careful about how I judge them, because I don't know what I'll do in the similar circumstances. I've told the story a number of times of my own past life recollection of someone who died in a gas chamber, and to my surprise, when this memory came up, the man was actually not afraid for himself. I mean, I think he had probably normal fear for himself, but the attitude with which he died, the overwhelming attitude, was one of compassion for the people around him who were dying around him. You know, as he died, he was showing compassion for this swarm of humanity locked into this room that was, into which poison gas was being introduced. And this was an ordinary person, you know. Principle of taking everything as being for our good, under really dire circumstances, the necessity of it can be more clear than under ordinary circumstances, more what we think of less stressful, less difficult circumstances. Nonetheless, it's equally true all the time. It's equally true and it's equally valid all the time. And, you know, putting it into practice, putting that teaching into practice, takes a lot of faith and a lot of determination. And you could say that really the whole focus of our practice in Buddhism and in our, you know, Serene Reflection School in particular, is in that direction. You know, there's a saying that when bowing ceases, Buddhism itself will cease to exist. That is passed on in our tradition. And it's saying the same basic thing. As everything that happens is for my good. You know, when you can't do anything else, you can bow. Even if you can't bow with your body, you can bow in your mind and in your heart. When you're up against circumstances that you can't do anything about, that are absolutely crushing, you can still bow. It's a choice you can make. And our whole practice is directed at inculcating that understanding and that habit into us of doing it. This is why we go around doing it all the time. And it does indeed become something that's habitual. I remember a number of years ago, many years ago now, like 20 years ago, coming back from Seattle one night, another one of the stories I told a number of times, unbeknownst to me, I'd gone from driving on wet pavement to driving on wet pavement that was frozen, so that it was like it was black ice, totally invisible. But it looked like regular wet pavement. I didn't know it was ice, but it'd been one of those freak situations in which I'd gone from an area that was warmer to one that was a lot colder, and I was driving along merrily along at, you know, 55 miles an hour on the highway. And as soon as the road made its first turn, my car kept going straight. And I crossed the other lane. There was no traffic. I crossed the other lane, and my car hit the gravel on the other side of the road, and it spun the car back in the road, and I went spinning down the center of the highway. And as I spun, you know, something in me just surrendered to the situation without any thought. Instead of, I didn't try to do anything. It was completely out of control. But I just, something in me just surrendered to the situation. I sat still while I spun down the road. And when the car stopped eventually, I was pointed in roughly the right direction, sitting in the middle of the road, right on the line between the lanes. So I started up and I crawled home. The only other vehicle I saw had actually gone off the road. But I attribute that instinctive reaction. It might have happened without all the training, and it might not have. I don't know. But I certainly think that all the years of just working at meditating and all the years of bowing really helped in that situation. Something in me instantly just let go. And of course, if I had tried to do anything, I could have just, you know, thrown the car, you know, into, you know, going back off the road again or something. Who knows? But my own view is that the merit of the training really helped me in that situation, and just helped it before I had time to think. It was just an instinctive reaction. You might say a kind of instinctive bow to something that I could do nothing about. And indeed, when I came out of those circumstances, I was not agitated. I've been plenty upset about other things, a lot more trivial than that. But I don't remember myself being upset. I was very careful going home the rest of the way. I still had about 13 or 14 miles left to go, and it took me maybe the better part of an hour to go that far, the rate I was crawling along. Because, I mean, the road was so slick, it was a solid sheet of ice, you could hardly stand up on it. I mean, literally, you could hardly stand up on it. So, you know, how do you put a teaching like everything that happens is for my good, which is so contrary to the way most of us were raised, and so contrary to the way the world views things? You know, how can you actually put that into practice? Well, when I have consciously put it into practice, it's always ended up being just a choice whether I would really focus within and really just work at making my meditation the focus of my daily activity, or whether I would just focus on worrying about, complaining about, mentally discussing with other people my doubts and worries and fears about external things. So it's always come back to a choice of whether to just really focus on being still and centered spiritually, or to allow myself to get scattered and caught up in external things. And the more turbulent the spiritual atmosphere, so to speak, is, the more stormy the spiritual weather is, the more I found the need to really consciously choose to keep the focus a more meditative focus. As our master used to say, you know, when the earth is shaking, sit still. And then, along with that, just work at bowing to the things that are the irritations, or the cause of worry or irritation, or the, you might say, the external trigger of my own emotional reactions, really bowing to them. Taking them as the Buddha that is teaching me, however much I may dislike them. You know, it doesn't mean you got to like what's going on. And there, This is one of these things where, without that stillness of the meditation, without really taking refuge in the stillness of meditation, these things look so real that it is really hard, and the good and evil look so real that it's very hard to take what looks as evil or bad as being for your good. So you need that deeper perspective where what seems so real now seems more remote, more ephemeral, more transitory. In other words, one has to get deep enough inside oneself spiritually, rooted enough in one's own Buddha nature, that the relative reality of external things is exposed. And the relative reality is described in the Scripture Eight Wisdom as void, unstained, and pure. Nowhere in the Scripture Eight Wisdom does it say, you know, evil is real, good is real. It says instead that when one with deepest wisdom of the heart, that is beyond discriminative thought, that is beyond judgmental thought, that is beyond judgments of good and evil, right and wrong, the Holy Lord, Great Kanzan, Avalokiteshvara, the heart of compassion within ourselves, knew that the skandhas five, what are the skandhas? Consciousness, body, feeling, volition, perception, sensation, knew that all of this is void, unstained, and pure. Well, it means that everything coming to the gates of the senses is part of that experience. That too is void, unstained, and pure. And what anything you can experience is coming to the gate of your senses by definition. So that must mean that everything you experience and everything you can experience, its real nature is void, unstained, and pure. It does not mean that its real nature is that of right and wrong, good and evil, better and worse, high and low, success and failure. It means the nature of all those opposites is actually void, unstained, and pure. So they do not constitute a real problem, however real they may seem to present themselves as being. Means all our doubts and our fears and our worries are not the true reality of things. That doesn't mean we can simply pay no attention to them, because sometimes we're afraid for a good reason and we're worried for a good reason. You know, if someone's coming after you with a hatchet, you know, the fear that arises is telling you, get away from this person with a hatchet. You see? And if the person with the hatchet corners you and chops you to pieces, that is not the true reality. There's something more real. This is exposing one of their making me think of one of the two guiding principles I was shown at the beginning of my retreat in 98-99. I was shown a little snippet of two past lives. And each of them I was given, as it was given, a teaching with it. And the first of these was a man in whose karma I had inherited in a yurt type of thing, like in kind of thing that's used in Mongolia, that kind of place, being attacked by a group of other men and killed. And the teaching that was given with this was very simple. And this is not my construction of it. The teaching was given right with the memory of the experience. And the teaching that was given was the weapons with which the man was killed, the Buddha, the act of killing is Buddha, the people who did the killing is Buddha, the whole situation is Buddha, and that was it. It's not like, oh, and you know, you have a right to grouch about it too. It was that was the teaching that was given with it. And it was like that was one of the two guidelines, the two guiding principles that I was being given to negotiate my way through the kind of karmic spiritual storm of the karmic washing that was coming over the succeeding months. The other one was a memory of a man who'd done some really awful things, but had done them with a really good purpose, and is in no way denying the awfulness of what was done. That was clear, but it was saying the teaching of that one was whatever people do, the fundamental intention underneath all the muck is a pure intention. Everything that happens is for my good is based in that fundamental truth that everything is Buddha. Not just the things we like are Buddha, the things we don't like are Buddha too. Not just the things we look on as good are Buddha, but the things we look on as evil are Buddha too. That doesn't make one want to go do evil, by the way. Karmic consequences, Buddha. And some karmic consequences is incredibly painful. Why would one, a normally functioning human being will not go running into making a huge amount of pain for themselves? The teaching that's given by both keeping the precepts and breaking the precepts, by the consequences of these actions, is Buddha too. It's all Buddha. So if you need a starting place in any difficult circumstances, your starting place can be, if you wish it to be, if you think of it or remember it, everything that happens is for my good. Again, that's not a magic wand that's going to remove all difficulties. That's not its purpose. It's the teaching that helps set you on the course of positively responding to whatever the situation is. You then have to, walk that path, and you're going to encounter whatever difficulties you encounter. There is no magic wand that removes karmic consequence. And karmic consequence is a lot easier to accept and to learn from when one is going from a positive position than from a negative one. And the reason for that is that the positive position is rooted in reality, and a negative one is not. There's another saying that Rinpoche Master used to quote, and Rinpoche Master did not invent this saying, of course, but he used to say it now and then. And it really says the same thing in just different words, and that is that God writes straight with crooked lines. And we need to remember that. Before we judge ourselves or others, before we judge the helpfulness or unhelpfulness of any external circumstances, remember, God writes straight with the crooked lines. And that sometimes we find in our experience, often we find in our experience, that however the difficult and circuitous the route traveled was, that at a later date we see that it was always functioning for our good and helping us. This is one of the really This was one of the great points I came to in my retreat in 98-99, and it took months of hard slogging to get to this, but eventually I ended up in this wonderful position of being able to look back upon all this misery and suffering and see no dust. Not to see the dust. And to look back on you know, a stream of karma in which there had been much misery and much confusion and some awful things done, and still not see the dust, but see the immaculacy of it. I have to say that that is not some kind of final position, although it is touching a bedrock of truth. Because, you know, time goes on and one's life goes on and there's still much to learn. And one still has to find the immaculacy in many other circumstances. So the last thing I want to say in this talk is something I said in another recent talk, but I want to say it again, that it's very easy to think that people like River Master Jiyu are like special people, or people like St. John of the Cross or the Buddha or Dogen. You know, these are like special people who have like a special capacity to see through the opposites to the reality of the Buddha nature. And that most of us don't have this capacity in the same way. And that we can't aspire to the same level of training, therefore. And I just want to say that there's absolutely no evidence to support such a point of view. There's no evidence that can support such a point of view. It's kind of like if one wants to see the glass as being half empty, there's a ton of evidence to support that point of view if you actually want to view it that way. But if you want to see it as half full, there's an equal amount of evidence to see it as half full. It's the same facts we're dealing with. It's how you're viewing the facts, you see. So, if we take the fact that, admittedly, to take everything as being for our good involves a lot of hard spiritual work. And sometimes you have to really hang on by the skin of your teeth while you struggle to come to that, to really come to that way of seeing things. Okay. Then you can say, well, the glass half empty view is that struggle is just, you know, I can't do it. That's for special people. The glass half full point of view is everyone's got that difficulty, encounters that difficulty, and some people really deal with it. And there's actually nothing in the way the universe is set up or in the way any of us is kind of pre-programmed, so to speak, that prevents us from being able to do it if we really want to and really decide we're going to work at it. And I'm saying this because I know from experience, both for me personally, I've been doing this training a long time now, and from doing a lot of talking with people, because as a priest you end up doing a lot of talking with people who are looking down about themselves and their own capacities. So I know from experience, both personal experience and experience of doing the job of a priest, how strong the tendency is to basically write ourselves out of the picture because something just seems so difficult. When in fact, and so many people actually write themselves out before they don't really ever give themselves a chance to learn how difficult it really is. Is it really as difficult as we think it is? Or have we just convinced ourselves that it's so difficult? we're pretty good at fooling ourselves, after all. And I think, you know, that for me, the enormous help of having such a great teacher was just that she was such a she was a human being like me and never pretended to be anything otherwise, who really seriously put the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors into practice and showed, well, an ordinary human being can do it. And wouldn't it actually be a disservice both to her and to me if I, as her disciple, said, oh, this is a special person. This is a special person, one of a kind of spiritual elite. And I can't ever be in that elite. And the truth of the matter is, remember, Master said it all the time, there is no elite. In the end, you know, we can choose our attitude that we're going to take. And it helps us if we have good teaching. And I think in our tradition, especially with all of us being really the followers of our Master Jiyu, because we all are. Some of us are direct disciples, have that good fortune. Some of us are not direct disciples, but it doesn't, in the end, directness or not directness, what's that matter? What matters is, you know, we have someone who has pointed the way so clearly and who left such a fine body of teaching. And someone who never said there's a special class of people. And this only applies to a special class of people. She rather affirmed the opposite of that again and again. You never know who's going to be the next person at the gate of the treasure house. That's the truth of the matter. It's not special prerogative of people we think of as Buddhas and ancestors. It's not the special prerogative of Zen masters, nor of senior monks, nor of monks, nor of lay ministers, nor of ordinary lay people. It's our common birthright. And that's the last thing I was going to say, but I guess I have an extra last thing. And that is that don't let anyone convince you that a teaching, this particular teaching of taking everything as being for your good, is something fanciful and not possible. Because it is something possible. And in my own experience, I proved it again and again in difficult circumstances. I proved it again and again. This works. I proved it again and again. It's how I got my first Kensho. It's exactly how I got my first Kensho. And it's how every major step of training I've taken since has involved doing this, making this choice. And because training is endless and ongoing, and because there's always bits and pieces of our karma that can at least potentially act upon us, it's a choice one has to keep making day in and day out in one way or another. But it is not just an ideal that's unattainable. It's actually a principle that's entirely based in the true reality of things. And it's something you can prove for yourself. As her master proved it for her, as I proved it for me. And in the end, it's what you prove to be true for yourself that helps you. It's not what someone else said. It's what you prove to be true for yourself. This teaching is so precious to me because it's helped me so much. And a teaching that is true will be a teaching that leads you in the direction of gratitude, not in the direction of complaining and finding fault. It'll lead you in the direction of having a generous, grateful heart, not a petty, complaining attitude of mind.